With the recent dramatic events in Pakistan, what next for Al-Qaeda? Hi, I'm Alex Page, and welcome to the Government Department Hot Seat. Today with us to talk about the future of Al-Qaeda is Professor John Sedell, Sir Patrick Gilliam Chair in International and Comparative Politics. Hi, John. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Following the killing of Osama bin Laden by American forces, what next for Al-Qaeda?
Well, not much. If we look back over the past several years, or even over the past decade since the September 11, 2001 attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., in large measure what you see after 2001 represents little in the way of a trajectory of growth, of diversification, of expanding recruitment, appeal, innovation in what remain a narrow set of sort of terrorist repertoires and a relatively small and arguably declining body of terrorist recruits. And in recent years, analysts who study trends in Islamist terrorism have argued in favor of both the emergence of what they call leaderless jihad, in which the small-scale occasional terrorist attacks in the name of Islam that you've seen in different parts of the world have been carried out in large measure by small numbers of individuals lacking in sort of large-scale organization and initiative, and instead perhaps enjoying some sort of inspiration from figures like Osama bin Laden. And alongside that, a decentralization of Al-Qaeda's effective operations so that you have groups in various parts of the world claiming affiliation with Al-Qaeda. So Al-Qaeda in the Land of Two Rivers, or Mesopotamia in what we would call Iraq, or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, in Saudi Arabia, and more recently remnants in Yemen, or in the Islamic Maghreb. But these sorts of groups, the extent to which they've been effectively directed, funded, operationally led and controlled by bin Laden, it's really rather attenuated. And to that extent, bin Laden's departure from this world at the hands of American Navy SEALs represents the disappearance of a symbolic figure who's used a certain kind of language and occupied a certain kind of place in the sort of social imaginary for Islamists, maybe for Muslims and non-Muslims in different ways. But in real terms, this is a small, marginal, fragmented, hemmed-in organization, insofar as it remains an organization. Many people are anticipating some effort at retribution, either of a nature that's organized by those who were close to bin Laden or those who would like to be associated with him. So one should not be surprised to see some sort of mobilization along those lines of small-scale terrorist activities. But the fact that a few weeks have now gone by and we've seen nothing is presumably revealing of something. The response to his death has not been large-scale mobilization, unsurprisingly, given the limits of his support and popularity. But also we haven't seen, as of yet, any successful terrorist response, really, of any size, to my knowledge. So that is revealing of how Al-Qaeda has really already proved to be a failure.
So what does this mean for the relationship between governments and Islamist groups around the world?
Well, it's hard to imagine that the entire apparatus of surveillance and funding and counterterrorism and all that will simply be folded up and removed from various police, intelligence, security agency budgets and bureaucracies. And it's hard to imagine that the full spectrum of Islamist activists will, you know, entirely forego violence in the name of Islam or terrorist violence in particular. But certainly it should do a couple things in terms of the global war on terrorism. It should give people a chance to take stock and to remind themselves that actually there's not that much of this out there. And certainly politicians and governments may feel responsible to their citizenry in terms of anticipating, preventing, preempting, and so forth, these sorts of possible attacks. But the extent of resources devoted to this cause, compared to other kinds of more worthy needs in societies, that might be worth reevaluating at this juncture. The second thing, obviously, would have to do with Afghanistan. I mean, here you have an elaborate and expensive set of American, British, and broader NATO commitments in Afghanistan, whose origin lay in the September 11, 2001 attacks, as opposed to any necessary antagonism vis-a-vis the Taliban. And with al-Qaeda removed from the equation, if al-Qaeda is a paper tiger, if Osama bin Laden is gone, if you can tick the box of, if not justice, then retribution and revenge, then it makes it easier politically in Washington, presumably, to pack up and leave, to draw down those sorts of commitments that supposedly are going to be reduced by 2014, and to allow or encourage some kind of deal between the Karzai government in Kabul and the Taliban. Why not? And just call it quits in that regard. So that's, politically, it might give more space for a movement that was already proceeding in that direction, but for which there's a larger regional context in terms of Pakistan and India, as well as Afghanistan.
What does this mean for the relationship between governments and Islamist groups around the world?
Well, what you can see in the Pakistan case most glaringly, but which is true in perhaps less obvious ways elsewhere, say Indonesia or Yemen or perhaps parts of West Africa, North Africa, is that a variety of governments have, through their intelligence agencies and security agencies, played a much more complicated game in terms of their relationships with not just Islamist movements, but clandestine armed Islamist groups in ways that involved covert sponsorship, protection, deployment, if not the creation of sort of false threats and the manipulation of that to extract resources and gain leverage vis-a-vis the United States. In the case of Indonesia, those sorts of relationships and that sort of game, which was very evident in 2001, 2002, that has already largely been played out and eliminated from the repertoire of games played by security agencies and the government in Indonesia. In Yemen, it remains a card in the hands of the Saleh government that has yet to fall, amazingly. And in the case of Pakistan, I think it's something that will continue indefinitely. If we look at what we're likely to see in weeks ahead in terms of evidence of direct Pakistani sponsorship and involvement in the Mumbai attacks of, I believe it was 2008, that we'll see more of in an upcoming trial in weeks ahead. I think it's clear that for Pakistan, deploying these sort of subcontracted armed Islamist groups is part of its long-term sense of embattlement vis-a-vis India. It's part of a foreign policy in which it perceives itself to be in a weakened position vis-a-vis India. It's part of Pakistan's domestic politics in which the military and also civilian governments find Islamist groups, armed and non-armed, useful vis-a-vis autonomous, sort of pro-autonomy and secessionist movements. And it's also part of the Pakistani relationship with the United States that has come in the wake of the end of the Cold War. It's easy to forget that in South Asia, a sort of tectonic shift did unfold with the end of the Cold War, in which the United States, after years of allying with Pakistan and against India, leapt at the opportunity from the 1990s forward to seal a new kind of alliance with India that had been prevented by the alliance politics of the Cold War era. And in terms of India as a market, in terms of India as a wedge against China, it's a very attractive relationship that the United States has actively, assiduously cultivated. And from the Pakistani perspective, their main game, their real asset, their leverage lies in this Islamist card. And that's how they can prove themselves to be useful. It's not just a bunch of crazies or a bunch of rogue elements in military intelligence. It is structurally part of a larger logic in which Islam is a weapon of the weak, of weak states in various regional contexts. You can see it also in terms of the unfulfilled promise of Iranian influence in the Middle East, in which Iran compensates for the way in which it is hemmed in by American, Saudi, Israeli, and other policies by funding various groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas, and otherwise. That kind of role for Islam in international relations that has to do with states and their instrumentalization of Islamist politics will live on even as the idea of transnational Islamist mobilization in the name of something grand like global jihad is clearly fading from view. And we can sort of kiss that goodbye with the death of Osama bin Laden.
Well, thank you very much, Professor John Sedell. You're now off the hot seat. And thank you for joining us. And stay tuned for the next edition of The Hot Seat.